Welcome to Brain Body Movement, a series of talks based on a lecture series of the same title. The talks will be done in a more informal style, so you may wish to consult the printed texts, which are made available to you on my website, www.sam-gill.com. I hope you enjoy the talks. Thank you. Some years ago now, I realized I had a difficult time making choices regarding some personal preferences. I can make decisions about many things, many of them having gravity and consequences, yet I found I couldn't say what color I most liked for a shirt or a car or a wall of a room. I have become increasingly aware of this lack. The tipping point came in two phases. In a moment of weakness, I watched the popular film Runaway Bride. There was that scene where Julia Roberts says that she ran away from the altar and numerous betrothed because she didn't even know what kind of eggs she liked. She'd always fallen for guys and just taken on chameleon-like whatever they liked. Thus, when she would get to the altar, she'd finally realize that she was losing herself without ever knowing herself. As silly as was this movie, I resonated with her problem. I recalled the scene in my mind every now and then. The final call of action, the tipping point, came when I flew to some city or other to do a lecture. I don't now recall where that was. I was picked up at the airport and taken to dinner, then to my hotel for the night. Bored but not tired, I flipped on the TV to see what was on. Amazingly, as the TV came on, it was playing the very scene in Runaway Bride where Julia Roberts is explaining to Richard Gere that she needed to determine what kind of eggs she liked. I took this extreme coincidence as a sign from the universe and decided I needed to follow Julia's lead. At that time, I was living in a large home in Niwot, Colorado, with a 400-square-foot room that I wanted to redecorate as a dance studio. I decided it was time to address this issue and that color was as good a way as any to start. It didn't seem enough to simply go to Sherwin-Williams, look at paint chips, and make a decision, so I began to do research on color. I looked at color charts to try to see the relationship between primary, secondary, tertiary color combinations and try to figure out how colors go together. I wanted to understand why colors can be placed on a wheel and why so many people have such strong opinions about what colors go, or maybe more strongly, why they don't go with other colors. Then I bought a bunch of color design books and looked at hundreds of photos of rooms and design ideas and various perspectives on how to use color and how to put colors together for different effects. I began to see that color schemes are most often identified with values. They're either warm or cool, they're invigorating or soothing. They're also correlated with eras like the 50s, for example, or they also have culture associations like Moroccan or Chinese or Ghanaian for that matter. Then one day I was talking to someone about my burgeoning interest in color and my newfound knowledge of the associations between color and culture. This person I was talking to replied, "Oh yes, that's why red is so often a royal color. Only royalty could afford red dyes." Well, this statement hit me like a brick, and I have to say that it took me a few days to admit, even to myself, its implications. You see, for some odd reason, I had stupidly not thought that chemically based colors have only been available in rather recent times. It had not dawned on me that not everyone could, in human history, simply run to the Home Depot and pick up any color at all, paying the same price for any choice. Once I'd swallowed my own embarrassment, I had newfound passion for learning more about color. Historically, every color has a story, and Victoria's wonderful book, Color, A Natural History of the Palette, does a terrific job of discovering and telling these stories. Color is of the earth, or perhaps more accurately, color is an amazing aspect of our relationship with the earth. Color is of people and their specific historical, geographical, geological relationship with the earth and with one another. Color has often been a factor in world politics and economics and war. Color is also of the imagination and can be appropriated to apply to surfaces to color things. Color has a psychological dimension in that we feel emotional responses to colors in our bodies much more powerfully than we have responses to color from the interpreter or language-generated part of our brains. The use of color as pigment or dye in some fashion or other is fundamental to all art. And then color has major philosophical and physiological and neurological and anthropological and psychological dimensions as well. It just seems it gets richer and richer. Indeed, it is fascinating that studies of culture have become watershed examples in a number of fields of study. I've read a lot of these modern studies of color, spanning several fields, and they've revealed a great deal to me in quite concrete ways about what we are as human beings. There are several types of studies or conclusions of studies. To me, the immediately most important findings in color studies are the following. First, those studies that convince us that color does not exist independent of our perception of it. While this aspect of color is a philosophical position at some point, it is a physiological and neurological finding at another. Second, those studies that convince us that while color tastes and color terms are culturally determined, certain aspects of color perception are universal among humans because of our common neurophysiology. Third, those studies that convince us that physiology of the color receptors in the eye, conjoined with neurological processing of this information, determines our identification of primary colors, despite the continuum of the color spectrum of light. This is why we see color bands in the rainbow rather than a smudge or a blur. And fourth, those studies that convince us that the categories we construct and by which we live are, like colors, constructs that emerge from a complex combination of physiological, neurological, biological, cultural, and personal sensory-motor involvements. Here, color is an exemplar of our human distinctiveness. Knowledge of these studies of culture, in my experience, actually make living as a human being in the world pop with vitality like seeing a Kandinsky painting. The idea that color does not exist independent of our perception of it is astounding, particularly when we extend this to all human experience of the world. It addresses an issue I've long struggled with. I've thought of it primarily in terms of what is sometimes called the anthropic principle. I've been unable to let it go. Strangely, I've always connected it with the idea of dinosaurs. You see, I cannot bring myself to believe that dinosaurs existed in some distant past. In fact, I have trouble accepting that anything can exist totally free of any awareness, either conscious or subconscious, of it at all. This would be a world empty of meaning in any possible sense. I certainly recognize that this is a homocentric view, thus the anthropic principle, but I can't let it go. I hear folks when they say, you know, existence may just not be about us. Still, there is no about, no existence, no distinction, no categories, apart from some confoundable being of some sort asking questions. It is arrogant to hold that the world exists only so that we may perceive it, but then I think that is precisely what these studies of color are telling us. We create color in the world as we interact with it. Thus, apart from us, there is no color in any sense we can imagine color to be. If a dinosaur can have no color apart from us, can there be dinosaurs? Varela, Thompson, and Rausch, in their book The Embodied Mind, refer to this interdependence as inaction. They put it quite well when they write, and I'll quote them here fairly extensively, "Color categorization in its entirety depends upon a tangled hierarchy of perceptual and cognitive processes, some species-specific and others culture-specific. They also serve to illustrate the point that color categories are not to be found in some pre-given world that is independent of our perceptual and cognitive capabilities. The categories red, green, yellow, blue, purple, orange, as well as light warm, dark cool, yellow with green, etc., are experiential, consensual, and embodied. They depend upon our biological and cultural history of structural coupling. It is really amazing that these color studies are able to demonstrate so convincingly this tangle of processes. Now I want to tell you about an experiment that was done with kittens, and you'll not soon forget it, that what it reveals is also extremely important. Scientists took a group of kittens and they kept them largely in the dark. When they would let them out from the light, they divided the kittens into two groups. One group was allowed to move about the environment under their own volition. The other group of kittens were moving about the environment, but they did so only by riding in little carts that were attached to the moving kittens. So that the experiment was to show that all of the kittens could perceptually experience the movement around the environment. But for one group, it was under their own volition. The other group, it was not. The results of this were really quite amazing, because only the actively moving kittens developed appropriate sight. The others simply stumbled around, fell off of things, and were functionally blind. The image of those kittens being pulled about by their siblings leaves us with another remarkable insight. And that would be that perception, indeed our world, depends on our willful and experiential action. We must explore our world through directed bodily movement in order to even see it. Non-directed, non-self-actuated movement, even the experience of differing perspectives through non-directed movement, is not enough to wire up our brains for meaningful sight. We must explore the world with our moving, experiential, touch-based bodies to see the world. This example shows us that even sight is actually based in the sense of touch, the sense that it is itself grounded in movement. Like my fixation on dinosaurs, I can't help but be concerned that as academics, we explore the world almost exclusively with eyes peering out of long, immobilized bodies. I cannot help but be concerned about our whole educational system that discourages touch and movement. Our understanding of learning is captured by phrases that are very familiar to us as we speak them to our children. You know these phrases. They're like, sit down, shut up, and keep your hands to yourselves. Of course, I understand that sight is enabled early in life. However, believing that neuroplasty is possible throughout life, I can't help but think that the sensory motor patterning of bodily inaction, of restricting movement to the stuttering index finger and the movement of mouth and eyes, has a major effect on what we value, on the values born in those subconscious schemas that Mark Johnson revealed as being foundational to all of our higher conscious, rational, cognitive processes. Surely the impact on us is enormous, and yet, as it is based in long ingrained and embodied patternings and schemas, we cannot even be aware of the deep effect on us. Verla Thompson and Rausch's work on category, as also Lakoff's, is quite remarkable, I think. Clearly, we do have a fairly embedded sense that categories work as they are envisioned in classical category theory. That is, that categories reflect the world as it is separate from us, and that members of a common category all share the same distinctive trait. Yet it doesn't take all that much to disenchant us with this theory when we consider our own practices related to category. Let's be ambitious and begin with the term that labels the category that gives us our sense of common identity, and that is the term religion, or the category religion. It is rather standard fare for students of religion at one time or another to think a bit, at least, about this term. Back in my graduate school days, it was common to attempt a definition of religion. This invariably led to collections of definitions that have been offered by religion scholars. It also led to trying to understand what we mean by definition and making distinctions between things like lexical definitions and phenomenological definitions. This discussion would arise because it used to be fairly widely held that religion is the ineffable, and how on earth can you define the ineffable? Such discussions of definition and even definitional strategies always become tedious to the max and eventually just plain boring. Most of these discussions simply provide a bit of lip service to the matter and go on. Still, this isn't completely satisfying or even acceptably academic. Jonathan Smith has made a strong case that we invent religion. Only some scholars are even open to this idea. The discussions of category provide some insight to the matter of defining religion. Rosch and Lakoff make much of the prototype theory of category. Rather than members of a category sharing one or more distinctive trait, these traits being definitional criteria, the prototype theory holds that categories are based on best examples, joined by others that can be related to them in various ways and degrees. Implications of the prototype theory also hold that categories like colors are not distinctions in the world independent of us. Rather, categories are the product of human interactions with the world, and clearly, like color, they are the product of a tangle of perceptual and cognitive processes, all ultimately grounded in body, in sight, in purposive movement, in brain, in touch. Biology, neurology, culture, history, and individual experience all play a part. Certainly, then, the term religion refers to a category constructed in the same fashion. The academic study of religion emerged largely from Christian studies. All one need do to be overwhelmed by the impact of this heritage is to read Walter Capps's book, Religious Studies, The Making of a Discipline. In this thick book, the first non-white, non-Christian, non-male scholar doesn't show up until near the end of the book. The sensory motor patternings that have created the schemas that we unconsciously draw on when we think of religion in any way are those experienced by thousands of dead white Christian men. Quite the groove. And it doesn't take a lily-funded study to identify Christianity as the operative prototype we continue to use, though now rather unconsciously, as our best case for our deeply embodied understanding of religion. As students of religion, virtually every question we ask, every subcategory we engage, every phenomenon we identify is rooted in an understanding of Christianity held not by the broad spectrum of practicing Christians throughout Christian history, but by that elite group of white male intellectuals that spent their entire lives sitting immobile, thinking and writing about Christianity. I am not sure we can grasp the depth and pervasiveness of the impact on us of these deeply ingrained sensory motor schemas. I suggest that they establish the reality of the academic study of religion, a level of subconscious and tacit agreement born in the body, the inactive body, to a highly restricted ontology. Notably, when understood in this highly restricted frame, we can appreciate that all the debated differences that have shaped the history of this academic study are but minor adjustments in an overly and narrowly determined world. Academics are kittens riding in carts pulled by others. In my first lecture in this series, I talked about the peculiar ways in which the academic study of religion seems to be limited. It has pretty much ignored such obviously religious phenomena as prayer acts, ritual, dancing, drama, music, art, and things of this sort. We can now perhaps begin to appreciate why such odd exclusions occur. They simply are not a feature that has been connected with aspects of the prototype of religion that our forefathers constructed and passed along to us. Valera, Thompson, and Rauch's extensive discussion of Buddhism as a traditional philosophical source to assist us in our understanding of inaction and its implications raise an interesting idea. Let us suppose that the academic study of religion had been based on an understanding of religion where the prototype for a religion was Buddhism. It would be interesting to take some time to start with this idea and play it out. My guess is that we wouldn't even end up with anything recognizable from our current practice. Clearly, how could an understanding with an operative prototype inseparable from an action ever lead to even the bodily comportment and practices of contemporary Western academics? Even the furniture of learning would be completely different. It seems that the implications of these insights are strong support for Smith's idea that we invent religion. But it also is strong support for the absence of our awareness that we do so. We simply don't know that we see red, blue, and yellow because of the complex entangled set of subconscious processes. Surely the cause is the same with religion, that such effects occur at the subconscious and bodily level to actually determine what we see and how we value what we see means that we are not aware of it. Yet we can know that these processes are at work and even specifically how they impact us. Yet I believe, always faithful to plasticity, that knowing something of the background of conditioning and determining processes, we can purposefully go about our work anew. Coming to know that the operative prototype for our study of religion is Christianity, we can do personal archaeology to learn how this shapes our world. Discovering the deeply determining nature of sensory motor patternings and their interconnection with cognition, we may finally recognize the potentially determining impact on the secondary. Discovering the deeply determining nature of sensory motor patternings and their interconnection with cognition, we may finally recognize the potentially determining impact of sedentary, immobile bodies, the icon of our educational system, and get up and start moving about. We can begin to exercise our body minds to create new sensory motor patterns that may embody new schemas which will change who we are and the world we experience. These are but a few ideas I have on the implications of color on our understanding of who we are as human beings and as students of religion. I will return to this topic for fuller discussion in a later lecture. Oh, and I did eventually paint that dance studio. Red with yellow ceilings, gold-yellow trim with a light berry purple accent in it, and I went on to design many of the features of my current house, which the neighbors all refer to as the colorful house. In this regard, there is perhaps one more relevant experience. To assure that I created and discovered my own taste in color, I knew that I simply could not consult with anyone. I knew that were I to ask even my dog what he thought about the color schema I was planning to use on the walls of this room, I'd read his every bark and drool as a critical statement, and I'd quickly change my mind. Week after week, I considered various combinations and gradually began to narrow my choice. Finally, I bought the paint, and when nobody was home, I spread out the drop cloth and I started one large wall. Remember, this wall was red. I painted a pretty large area and walked across the room to give it a look. My stomach churned, my head spun, and I nearly threw up. When you first see a large area of red on a wall that has been quite bland, it is a huge emotional shock. I sat down, I had to, and began to consider rushing back to the paint store to get a nice beige to overpaint the red. At that moment, a young woman who was renting a room from me walked in. Yikes! Caught in the act. Her immediate response was, "I love it, it's so you." This was the immediate response of virtually everyone who ever saw it. We had many dance parties in that room while I lived there, some even with live salsa bands. The room came to be known as Sam's Club. The lesson here may be that we might undergo the same emotionally wrenching process in trying to repaint our field of study, but I have faith that we would enjoy what comes of it. Thank you for listening to this volume of Brain Body Movement, a series of talks based on a lecture series by the same title. I am making this lecture series in print form available to you on my website, www.sam-gill.com. Thank you very much for listening to this volume, and I'll be talking to you again later. Bye-bye.